Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. For our second episode, I wanted to address a topic that is currently having an unfortunate impact, the effects of huge amounts of nitrates being washed into our rivers and streams after the application of copious amounts of fertilizer and manure. Iowa is the number one state in confined animal feeding operations for hogs and the number one state for confined animal feeding operations with chickens, particularly egg-laying hens. A story in Little Village magazine last year reported that Iowa produces the most waste from factory farms in the country at a staggering 109 billion pounds of waste each year. We're going to be talking a lot about nitrates in the upcoming weeks and interviewing a lot of impressive scientists and experts from the Midwest, but I thought it might be nice to start with a primer on the subject from someone who's played an important role in turning around a nitrate problem in another part of the country. My guest for this episode is Dr. Christopher Gobler, the Endowed Chair of Coastal Ecology and Conservation Distinguished Professor at Stony Brook University in New York. Dr. Gobler, as his title suggests, is an expert in ecology, and he's someone who has put forward the case previously that the current EPA limit for nitrates might not be strict enough. What's especially interesting about Dr. Gobler's work, in my opinion, is how Suffolk County in New York went from being seen as having a huge problem with nitrates in their drinking water to now being viewed as a model for other places who want to make improvements. Of course, in order for this to happen, the state of New York and the local government had to acknowledge the science and not just shrug their shoulders, but instead decided to do what it took to address the issue. As always, you can find the Harkin Institute at harkininstitute.drake.edu and also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can find some show notes with links to some of the studies mentioned at Canary in a Cornfield at Substack. Thanks for tuning in. I am really happy today to be joined by Dr. Christopher Gobler, the Endowed Chair of Coastal Ecology and Conservation Distinguished Professor at Stony Brook University. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Gobler.
Yeah, my pleasure, Adam.
The first thing I wanted to mention is just that we're starting this new podcast about the connection between agriculture and public health, and nitrates obviously is one of the biggest issues in Iowa, and I think one of the biggest issues in agriculture across the U.S. So we're really thrilled that you agreed to be one of the early guests. So I just wanted to say that. And then I also thought it might be helpful to get out of the way a potential objection, since I am in Iowa, what I would call the paste picante sauce objection of New York. What does New York have to do with agriculture? Of course, I know better, but maybe you could say a few words about the connection between agriculture and New York for people who might think of New York just as New York City.
Yeah, well, I'm a professor at Stony Brook University, and Stony Brook is in Suffolk County. And as it turns out, Suffolk County historically has been the most productive agricultural county in New York State out of 62 counties. And then a second issue, actually, is that in Suffolk County, beyond the agriculture, we've got 1.5 million people, and only about 30% of them are actually connected to sewage treatment plants. So we have a second nitrogen issue, and that is that we've had accumulating levels of nitrate in our groundwater, which is also our drinking water, not exclusively because of agriculture, but actually due to what we call on-site wastewater, and that the fact that 70% of these homes, and I said it's 1.5 million, so that's almost a million of them, are just draining the wastewater goes from the home into a septic tank and or cesspool that then just drains into the ground. And that's led to rising levels of nitrate in our groundwater, and some places approaching well over 10 milligrams per liter, and on average about 4 milligrams per liter, which is compared to the national average for groundwater and drinking water that's rather high.
Thank you. Well, tell me a little bit about your career and how you got interested in this issue originally and how you got to the point where you are now.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I grew up actually where I am on Long Island. And when you grow up on Long Island, for most people, you appreciate coastal waters. And so I grew up fishing, grew up sailing with my father. I've always enjoyed swimming and had both family members and people I knew who grew up as baymen. And so in the big fishery when I was growing up in the 70s into the early 80s was baymen would dig for clams, particularly in the South Shore of Long Island. And when I was in college studying towards my degree in biology, during the summer, I worked for environmental groups, and the group that I was working for would bring in speakers every week. But they were bringing speakers from not just environmentalists, but people who are dealing with environmental issues. And so one week they brought in a bayman, and he just essentially described how he was a bayman, and his father was a bayman, and his grandfather was a bayman. And he assumed that multi-generational lineage would pass on to his son, except that the clam fishery was collapsing. And that was almost no longer viable. He was probably going to have to get out, and he knew that his children would not be able to continue it as well. And that was, for me, a really horrific story. The bay should always be there. In some ways, it's like agriculture. We think about it that way here. Some people just think, instead of farming the land, you're farming the bottom of the bay. But that was collapsing. And so I asked why, and the bayman said, oh, well, it's brown tide. What's brown tide? And he just said, well, it's some sort of algae. And I asked what caused it. He didn't know, and nobody knew because it was brand new. And anyway, that inspired me to go to graduate school and to study brown tide, actually. And that's actually what I studied in graduate school for both my master's and my PhD, and specifically what causes it. And in the end, what became clear is that one of the causes is high levels of nitrogen. There's some nuance in there with regards to timing and different types of nitrogen in the water, but suffice to say, that was the link. And you know, the sudden appearance of this algal bloom, and then since through my career, many others, we call these things harmful algal blooms. And they occur in Iowa as well, though they're more likely in freshwater. The idea is that the overgrowth of an algae can have an ill effect on the ecosystem. And what we saw for brown tide and then other harmful algal blooms that have emerged since is that high levels of nitrogen make these algal blooms grow faster. And we've had both the types of harmful algal blooms that are what we call ecosystem disruptive or destructive, which is like the brown tide. And then we've had others that can be dangerous to humans because they make biotoxins. And again, the link there being high levels of nitrogen is just more fuel for these events, particularly when it's delivered to what we call a hotspot for one of these blooms.
Yeah, fascinating. As a side note, that's really wonderful that you were able to end up teaching in the same area that you grew up. It's a tough academic market, so that's wonderful to be able to still be where you grew up and make a difference there. So Iowa has actually been facing what I would call a cancer crisis lately. We've been the number two state in cancer for 3 years in a row. We're one of the only states where the cancer rate has been rising while the national average is dropping. And so I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the possible connections between nitrates and the risk of cancer.
Yeah, sure. Well, first, that's not great news, and I'm very sorry to hear that. Yeah, so as I've worked on the idea of looking at nitrate in groundwater and how it affects surface waters, another thing I've also been looking into in my role of both as a professor, I also direct something in New York State called the New York State Center for Clean Water Technology. And one of the focuses is how do we get nitrogen out of groundwater? And we've been focusing on wastewater and agriculture, but we also do think about, and here on Long Island, actually, our groundwater is our drinking waters. So we don't rely on surface waters. And anyway, I'm sure you and your listeners are familiar with the fact that the EPA has a guideline for nitrate in drinking water that's set at 10 milligrams per liter, and that's to prevent something known as blue baby syndrome, where if there's high levels of nitrate in your blood, it can compete with the binding of oxygen in your blood, and the byproduct can be low oxygen, particularly in babies. So that's been the standard for a long time, but what I've been tracking is new research that's been coming out, and the first studies of this were decades ago, but it's really been remarkable how the research into health effects of nitrate has really been expanding. Just more and more research now globally on what are the health consequences of high nitrate in drinking water beyond this blue baby syndrome, and specifically focused on cancer.
Yeah.
And as study after study is revealing that there are links, there are these positive associations, with high nitrate in drinking water and higher incidence of cancer, typically gastrointestinal cancers, although there's been some others that have been linked to it as well, but most commonly gastrointestinal. And the concerning part of these studies, and I will caveat being that to date they've been epidemiological studies, but that's what we have to go on. The concerning part is that it's not at 10 milligrams per liter, but these higher rates of cancer incidences are being observed at significantly lower levels of nitrate in drinking water. Some studies as low as 2 milligrams per liter. In other cases, it could be 4 or a little bit higher than that. But that's concerning because what it suggests is that that EPA standard of 10 may not be protective against cancers. These studies keep coming out and I track them. Stony Brook University, where I'm a professor, also is a very good medical school. So I've been in touch with epidemiologists there and find this concerning as well.
That was something I wanted to ask you about too, that 10 milligrams per liter. So is it fair to say that you think that that is too high at this point and that it should be lowered, or how do you think about that limit?
Yeah, well, I mean, a few things. One, if I'm tracking the EPA correctly, it looks like they're going through a process. It's called IRIS and it's been a multi-year process, but I don't want to make grand declarations, but I can point to some studies that have come out, one by a professor at a Duke University and another that just came out of the Netherlands in the last year. And they both came to the same conclusion. So I'll point to those studies. And those conclusions were, if the nitrate standard for drinking water was reduced, and I know the Netherlands study, they said specifically 4 milligrams per liter. They both came to the same conclusion. If we drop the standard, it would be a net economic benefit to the country. And again, the Temkin and Al study with the Duke scientist was in, for the U.S., the other study was for the Netherlands. But for both countries, there'd be a net economic savings for the country because even though obviously it will cost money to reduce the nitrate in the drinking water, will be more than offset by the healthcare savings because people aren't contracting cancer. So I would point to those studies and saying, if we have a situation where we're saving money and people are healthier, sign me up.
Right.
Would be my conclusion.
So you mentioned some of the ecosystem effects, and I'll come back to that in a second. You mentioned blue baby syndrome. Are there any other harms that could come from high levels of nitrates in the water beyond the ones that we've talked about already?
Well, I'm a marine scientist or an aquatic scientist. There's the algal blooms that happen, but there's plenty of trickle downs that happen as well within the ecosystem. So you get an algal bloom, the water becomes murky, you lose habitat potentially. The oxygen levels in the ecosystem can drop down. That can kill off marine life. There was even a study locally here that linked home values to water clarity. And so specifically when the water became more murky, people's home values dropped. And this is for all of Suffolk County. And again, the link there being higher nitrate, more algal blooms, water more murky, your home is less valuable. So there's the trickle-down ecosystem effects that are concerning. And then, like I said, people economically, and it makes sense, right? If you have a beautiful home on the water, but that water is some odd color that you don't want to swim in, it's not going to be as valuable as if the water is more pristine.
I know in the past you've spoken a few times about the idea of a tipping point where ecosystem damage can become irreversible. Could you say more about that concept and whether you're worried about it in this context?
Yeah, that's an ecological concept of the tipping point, whereby once an ecosystem shifts, it's questionable, can you get it back to where it was? And sometimes you need to, there's more effort to get it back if you can get it back. And the issue there is also that oftentimes you don't know what that tipping point is. So that is to say, you don't have the forewarning that, oh, well, if you get to this stage, then you'll never get that fishery back. You don't know until it all happens and suddenly we can't get the fishery back. And that would be for freshwater and for marine ecosystems. And on the ecosystem front, an exacerbating factor in a lot of these aquatic ecosystems can be a warming climate. And so we know that the whole planet's experienced warming. And I always say it's all, there's the idea of global warming, which is not necessarily as important as local warming, right? Because you're interested in a specific ecosystem. But here in New York, for example, our summers are getting much, much warmer at a more rapid rate than the global average. And that's a compounding factor whereby, you know, if we're already 3 degrees warmer in summer, and then you add on these other issues like the algal blooms and the high nitrate, you know, that sometimes can push things past the tipping point faster than it would be if it was just the high nitrogen.
Sure. Yeah, that's really fascinating. In Iowa, we definitely have issues more with freshwater, as you say, where lots of people here remember being able to swim in lakes and streams when they're younger. And now oftentimes those are not safe. And of course, a lot of places get their drinking water from some of these freshwater sources that can have high nitrates. We don't think a huge amount about marine ecosystems here, but what happens in Iowa could have an effect downstream where the Mississippi enters the Gulf.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's well known that through the 20th century, the levels of nitrate in the Mississippi River, I think doubled, is correct to say, at least, and that associated with the increase in agriculture post-World War II. So there are downstream effects there. But just staying in the freshwater systems, the old paradigm used to be, oh, on freshwater, we only have to worry about phosphorus, and that's what's controlling the ecosystem. But there's been a new paradigm established in the last decade or so that it's very clear nitrogen is also quite important in controlling and influencing algal blooms in freshwater systems, lakes and ponds as well. And a particular type of harmful algal bloom that happens in freshwater are cyanobacteria. And one of the most common type is, it's known as Microcystis. It makes a toxin called microcystin. That toxin is actually a nitrogen-rich compound. And so you can have the situation where more nitrogen makes these blooms more toxic. If they have more nitrogen, they can make more of the toxin. So yeah, there's definitely downstream marine effects with regards to the Gulf of Mexico and with sort of the dead zone there. But there's also plenty of incidences of these harmful algal blooms in freshwater systems in Iowa as well.
For sure. So this podcast is focused on the connection between agriculture and public health. Are there particular agricultural practices or systems that are more likely to cause high nitrate levels?
Yeah, I mean, in happy news, there's definitely the case where environmental solutions that are also agricultural solutions. I work with some farmers here in New York, and they'll be the first to tell you that they don't want to put down more fertilizer than they need to. They have to spend money on that. And so the more efficient that they can be in their application of the fertilizer, the less money they're spending on it, and therefore the less that's making its way downstream. There's also the potential to sort of capture runoff from fields and then reuse that water, because that water is rich in nitrogen. So by watering with the runoff water, if it's collected, sometimes called fertigation. So instead of it washing downstream, if it can be collected, that also is valuable. You wouldn't have to apply as much fertilizer because you're recapturing it. And then there's also means, of course, for treating the runoff. If it can't be recaptured, there's tile drain field capture of that runoff whereby you can treat it, say, with, we call them thermally reactive barriers. But essentially, if you can create a system where you can get the oxygen to go anoxic, say, with a wood chip-based products and either a barrier or some sort of area where you can have the water be denitrified, you can then remove that nitrogen. But, you know, there's certainly lots of practices. And again, it doesn't, sometimes people frame environmental issues or environmental slash public health issues as it's the economy or it's public health or it's the economy or the environment. But there's definitely room for a win on both sides because, like I said, no farmer wants to see the money they spent on fertilizer get washed off of the field. So whether it's more judicious application, different types of fertilizer that's more likely to stay there, and or capture of the runoff that gets reused, and these are all things that would be an economic benefit and a public health benefit.
Yeah, that's a great point. I wonder if in Iowa, there's a little bit of a different incentive structure that might push in the other direction, which is that we're the leading hog producing state. So we have fine animal feeding operations and they sort of have more manure than they know what to do with. So I think that might complicate the incentive structure for being very precise about the level.
Yeah,
applied in some cases, but
But again, I don't know the details of agriculture in Iowa, but I do know corn is also an important product there. And so one farmer's waste could be another farmer's treasure if that, you know, manure can somehow be converted. But again, some of this probably needs to be fine-tuned a bit.
How do you feel about different technological solutions where I know there's some companies looking into trying to use gene editing to change the way nitrogen is fixed in certain crops? Is that something you're optimistic about?
I mean, certainly, yeah, the idea of getting more nitrogen-fixing crops into the ground could limit the amount of fertilizer that's being used or make those soils more rich in nitrogen. You know, I don't know if that has to be done via gene editing or not. Different people have different feelings about GMOs. And in some ways, I often feel that the horse is out of the barn already on that front, so to speak. But yeah, I think more nitrogen-fixing crops can be a benefit that could be done without gene editing. Perhaps it could be done a lot more efficiently with gene editing, but it's a little out of my realm.
Sorry. I might have gone down a niche that I'm especially fascinated by. But I guess staying in this realm of potential solutions, you've pioneered this idea of a nitrogen credit payment program. Can you say more about how that works?
Yeah, I mean, the idea, I'm not sure how it would translate for you all in Iowa, but I can say in New York, there's a lot of money being spent on, I mentioned when we first started that a big source of nitrogen are these septic systems, and the idea therefore being like, yeah, we probably shouldn't be putting our wastewater into our drinking water source. Let's do better than that. So the government's therefore investing a lot of money on either upgrading people's septic systems or hooking them up to sewage treatment plants, either of which would remove nitrogen from getting into the groundwater. But there's other activities that do the same thing. And so, for example, again, it'll sound foreign to folks in Iowa, but people do, in addition to agriculture in New York, we also have something called aquaculture, right? And so that's the growing of marine organisms. It can be freshwater as well, but marine organisms for harvest. And a lot of that gets done with either, traditionally New York, actually, where the biggest aquaculture source is actually filter feeding bivalves, so things like clams, oysters, mussels, scallops. And as they grow, they're filter feeding. So they're actually taking up plankton and in the process taking up nitrogen. A secondary target that's emerging in aquaculture are seaweeds. And again, people sometimes would think seaweed, that's just what washes up in the shore. But there are certain types of seaweeds, for example, sugar kelp, that can be used as a food item, a food additive, and we've turned it into fertilizer even. And the idea is, if people are growing bivalves or seaweeds, and I should mention, of course, as the seaweeds grow, they're extracting the nitrogen out of the seawater, same as the bivalves. So we call this bioextraction. And so the concept is the government's spending a lot of money for getting nitrogen out of water from septics and such. If there are people farming these marine organisms that are doing the same thing, getting nitrogen out of water, maybe they should be given some credit and encouragement to do that. And so it's just the idea, therefore, a nitrogen credit is if you're getting nitrogen out of the water, and this is something that we deem a public benefit, and we, as this conversation's going on, clearly is a public benefit, right? It has public health benefits, ecosystem benefits. Maybe that's something that could be invested in order to incentivize it. And there's different schemes. The one that I had toyed with was more privately run, so getting people who want to support that and have the funding come from there, but there could be ways for it to be publicly run or public-private partnership. But again, it's just incentivizing practices that get nitrogen out of water.
That's a really neat idea. Are there other policy approaches that you think might be helpful at the federal level or state level or local level?
Yeah, there's one that comes to mind that's been hugely successful here. First, New York has, as a state, put a lot of money into what I could call clean water infrastructure. So putting money in the state budget to upgrade sewage treatment plants and actually to literally give money to people to upgrade their septic systems. But another one that's been very successful has been something called the Community Preservation Fund. And yeah, nice name. And essentially the concept is that on any real estate transaction, there's a fee levied. I think it's something like 2%. And usually real estate transactions are large sums of money. There's a lot of money up there and a lot of money being paid for extra things. And the idea here is there's therefore a certain small tax put on that money then goes aside, and that money is used in part for infrastructure to clean up water. So, for example, I'll throw out some numbers that will probably sound crazy, but you can upgrade your septic system in certain parts of New York and get up to $45,000 for that activity. Now, you can't make a profit on it, but believe it or not, in some cases, for some very large houses, you know, it can cost that much money. There's now public funds available through this program and some from state programs to do that at no cost. So both the insulation and the restoration of the property. But that concept that there's a small amount of money that's put aside on the transfer of real estate, you know, is one that's been, I think, pretty successful. And again, homes are always selling. So that's one that's, I think, been good.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah. Are there any other potential ways of trying to address it? Anything people in Iowa should be thinking about?
Yeah, I will offer again that we're the New York State Center for Clean Water Technology that I run. We have created these septic systems that remove like 90% of nitrogen. And we've also created these other things called permeable reactive barriers of different ilks that are meant to intercept water as it flows and get the nitrogen out that way as well. And that could have applications in agriculture.
There was one other question I wanted to ask earlier, which is the issue of there being high levels of nitrates in the water. How has that changed? Do you see that as something that's improving nationally? Are there any trends that are making it worse, or how would you characterize that?
Yeah, my sense right now is that there's a little bit of an awakening towards this idea that high nitrate is more of a health risk than we recognize. And so I'd say here in New York, we're on the path for specifically Suffolk County. We're on the path for turning the tide. The technology's in place, the programs are in place to start reducing the nitrogen. And I think other places in the agricultural setting where I wouldn't say necessarily things are getting worse rapidly, but in some cases, the nitrate levels are just too high. I'm seeing here and in other places more than 10. We have some agricultural sites for more than 20, and that's, something that needs to be worked on. So I think the first step in the journey is recognizing we have a problem. And the next step is getting consensus on that recognition and then working towards a solution.
Yeah, for sure. What other groups or other universities have you been working with? Are there different geographic regions who have approached you and said, oh, what you're doing seems amazing, we want to implement it here?
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is that in some ways, 10 years ago, Suffolk County was in a really bad situation whereby, like, literally our toilets were flushing into our drinking water source, right? And of course, separated by dozens of feet, but still, you know, not great. And about that time, people in Suffolk County decided, like, enough's enough. We now know this is not a great idea. And so people in Suffolk County and the government, and also in academia, so some people from Stony Brook, went to some different neighboring states. It's called the Magical Septical Tour, to see what was going on there. But the upshot is now 10 years later, I think Suffolk County has become a model for other places. And so there are places now in Massachusetts that originally that we had looked at a decade ago that are now looking back here and saying, oh, you made a lot of progress. So how do you do that? And some other places in New England, and certainly there are along the East Coast and Florida and places in between, there are places where the on-site septic is a problem and getting beyond discharge to ground is important.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Gobler. I really appreciate that important information and the great work that you're doing to improve public health. So thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
Yeah. Great to speak with you, Adam, and thanks for having me.
For this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Just a reminder, you can find us on social media, on X, on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at harkininstitute.drake.edu. And this podcast is hosted by Substack at Canary in a Cornfield. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will